so why don't we go ahead and call a meeting to order. This is a special set-aside committee meeting. This is not our normal quarterly meeting. This meeting has been called to address the issues that were raised during our last quarterly meeting in regards to a proposal submitted by Quality Control for office supplies. That is the only agenda item today. We won't be discussing any other business, and we will commence doing minute approvals and stuff like that at our next quarterly meeting. I wanted to keep this meeting focused and targeted on what was requested at the last meeting. So there will be an opportunity for a call to the public. Just understand it's not going to be addressed until the next public meeting. Are there any questions before we start? Okay. I'd like to go ahead and do a roll call. We'll just start.
Gary Hahn, DES Procurement.
Glenn Newman, EDU Test.
Rick Crago, Arizona Lottery.
Dick Monaco, Arizona Industries Food One.
Steve King, Beacon Group.
Jim Apperson, Department of Economic Security.
Barbara Carolla, State Procurement Office.
Carol Carr, Chief Human Services.
Manny Salazar, ECA.
Brian Rudecki, Arizona Correctional Industries.
Thank you very much. So last meeting, we actually had a couple of action items that were moved and seconded from the July 17th meeting, and that directly related to the QC proposal for office supplies. One of the first items was that we needed to deal with QC's offer as it related to conflicts within other set-aside contracts such as ACI, potentially Arizona Industries for the Blind, or even QC in itself as they supply some other items under a separate contract. QC did submit a revised Excel spreadsheet that was a little too voluminous to print and bring in here. So why don't I let you kind of go back through how you approached that item and what you've done to that spreadsheet.
Sure. Well, we worked with closely with ACI, with Mr. Radecki's counterpart, Tom Brown, there, in order to identify items that would potentially conflict with items that ACI currently sells, both set-aside products and non-set-aside products. And so we removed over 3,000 items. Every single item that ACI identified has been removed from our price list completely in order to remove any conflict between the two. So that reduced our overall catalog from about 32,000 now to about 29,000.
Is that acceptable?
Yes. Yes, it's acceptable. We worked together. There were some last minute changes, a couple items were left on there, but those have been taken off, so we're okay with those.
If I may ask, what items were removed, not each one, but categories? They were talking about furniture and other things.
Well, those were the primary categories, were trash liners, base cabinets, all kinds of furniture really, including base cabinets, desks, tables, shelves, and hutches. All those things that kind of broadly conflicted with some of the items that ACI produces. In addition to that, trash liners, as I mentioned, cardboard boxes,
chairs,
which there was a whole large amount of chairs, ink refills, keyboard trays, and my favorite one, cookies. We saw that ACI actually produces some cookies, and we didn't want to have that conflict, and so we removed a whole bunch of cookies from our price list. Which the state doesn't need to purchase those anyway, probably.
I'm just leaving that one alone. Are there any other questions about the product listing under the QC proposal, whether from AIB or others?
No, none from AIB.
Hearing that, one of the other issues under discussion is how did you validate your competitive pricing process? What did you use to validate the prices that you would charge are actually competitive against what currently is available either retailing or to the state?
Well, we maintain that MSRP is a good benchmark of what is competitive in the private sector. And as everyone here knows, the statute requires competitiveness with the private sector. But in order to give the committee additional peace of mind, we performed an analysis of the current contract and its pricing structure. And it's another enormous spreadsheet, and so I didn't email it or print it out, but I can describe the analysis to you in detail. So we took their 20,078 products that are on the current contract list and took their MSRP and basically applied the pricing structure that we're using in our proposal to the current contract pricing list. And so we took a 32% discount off of MSRP, off of the MSRPs on Staples list. We took an additional 9%, which is the average sales tax benefit. So 41% total discount off of those MSRPs in order to see what our pricing structure would look like if applied to Staples' current catalog or the current contractor's catalog. And what we found is average on those 20,000 items that if the current contract was structured the way our proposal is, it would yield a $6.35 savings average across all 20,000 items. As we mentioned at the last meeting, it's really impossible to compare apples to apples with these two very large and complex lists. But this analysis, we believe, shows the committee the true competitiveness of our pricing structure without being able to directly compare apples to apples. So in total, if the state were to purchase one of every item on the current contractor's list under our structure versus the current structure, it would save the state $127,000.
Does anybody have any questions regarding this?
Yeah, you're talking about 40, what did you say for the max would be 41%?
41% average, yeah. And that depends on the sales tax in the community where.
Because I looked at our current contract, and our discount rates from listed on the current contract run from 40 to 69%.
Yeah, and he was talking on average because they get a flat 32% across the product line.
Well, I understand that. So what I'm saying is even if at 40%, we only have a few items here at that level. Most of them are discounted higher than 40%. So how, I'm trying to see how that math matches up. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
It depends on what their negotiated rate is from the manufacturer. Could be higher than MSRP.
They're supposed to be both taken off of MSRP.
Supposed to be. Absolutely.
So should be dealing with the same base.
Should be.
There's also the last year of the contract doesn't go off of that price off of retail. The last year of the contract with the current contract, prices range anywhere from 25% off of retail to 25% above retail, which is the new price list of the current contract, which is, I believe it's 2013. So that price list that you're looking at right there and the current contract or the current price list don't match up because that's an old price list. They don't even show a core list off of there. So it's the last year of prices for the Staples contract is not, there's a new price list. And I'm not certain that that's the current price list that you have there.
When you get a new price list, you don't get a new percentage off. The new percentage off is not negotiated every year. That would be the same percentage off. The price list definitely varies. They print new those, but I still get 41% off this category for the whole term of the contract. The retail price or MSRP can fluctuate,
right.
But that 41% does not fluctuate.
And if I can add to that, Rick, and maybe help clarify a little bit, the current contract has a core list and a non-core list.
Well, yeah.
And so we acknowledge that the percentage discount on that core list for the current contract is greater than the discount that we're able to offer. But the items, many of the items off of that core list, the general items, and to put it in perspective, the core list is about 250 items out of 20,000. So about 1% of those items. The other 99% vary in their percentage off, which is why we provided the average figure so that the committee could compare the pricing on the entire catalog versus just the core list. And core lists are used.
Yeah, this doesn't count the core list. The core list is 77%. This is just across the board commodities. This doesn't reference, because there's only 293 items, I think, on the core list. So I'm just trying to figure out how, if everything we have is discounted on the contract at a higher rate than what he's discounting, how is this probably less expensive?
Again, I think you look at if you take, and again, without seeing the actual calculation of what they're comparing point to point, I can't tell you specifically where they're adding up, but remember his offer is also not mandatory, so it would be optional. It's not something that is going to potentially replace a Staples contract. It could be in addition to a Staples contract. I also know that there are some things that the state orders that Staples doesn't have, size-wise, spec-wise, or if you wanted it, I'm actually experiencing this. I want a specific whiteboard every time I try to order a whiteboard out of Staples. Oh, that's been discontinued or it's not back, which we're working through. But so I agree that it looks like I have higher percentages, and his is 32 compared to minimum of 41. I think at that point it could potentially be the choice of a buyer as to which contract they would purchase off of. But I'm sure he'll send us the list so we can peruse the map on that as well.
So if this is up for vote today, and it's our obligation to determine and make sure that competitive pricing is the pricing is competitive. There isn't anyone on this committee who can stand up and say that it's competitive. All we're doing is hearing comments from someone who's done an analysis that says it's competitive, but no data has been formulated by this committee to verify that.
That's good.
And there probably isn't anyone on this committee except for people from ADOA who have the ability or the skill set, resources to be able to do that. So I'm lost here as to what am I going to do when it comes to competitive pricing? What decision should I make?
Number one, you don't have to make a decision today. The question was just to get the responses to those items that were directed to be investigated by the committee from the last meeting. If the direction of the committee is that now that we understand how they're determining price validity, that we go back and validate price validity based on the information he provides, that's an option for the committee to do. Okay, so it's not a hard and fast, you have to make a decision today.
Was there a problem with the date? Contract.
The data, actually, the contract was extended. The office supply contract originally was set to expire September the 9th, but that has been extended through the end of the year. We're not worried about time frame, but we do want to get it right. From that perspective. And I know that QC has put a lot of work into trying to respond to the information that the committee has requested. So we still wanted to try to meet the initial request of having the meeting by September 9th. So that we can get this information, because there was some requirements that would work with the Attorney General's office as well. So we kind of want to keep the momentum, per se, moving with this request.
If I may just respond to Mr. Monaco's comments, and just to remind the committee that the requirements of the statute are that quality and price are equal with materials and services available in the private sector. And I think 41% off of MSRP, if we accept MSRP as a definition of what is a fair market value, 41% less than that is by definition competitive with the private sector. I hear what you're saying, that the committee would like to go further and really see if it's competitive with the current contract as well, and that's why we provided the additional analysis. But I believe that we have shown that it is indeed competitive with the private sector.
One quick question. You had mentioned that there was 250 base parts that were the majority of the Staples contract.
That's the core items. So
core
the state item. Would sit there and look at like the top 250 items that we purchased, and then we use our the LISCA contract. Typically, we'll use that as the benchmark for evaluation to award a contract. It's definitely not all inclusive of what we buy, but it's not your top 250 items because that's where the majority of your spend is.
Right. My question was how do you compare with those 250 parts?
Well, again, we have not done an apples-to-apples comparison because we believe that the structure of the proposal that we're putting forward is very different from the core list proposal. What the core list does, in essence, is it's a contractor offering incredible prices on those items in order to make their profit on other items that are off of that list. And so our proposals is an attempt to simplify that for state purchasers who may, you're right, may get an incredible deal on that core list item, but may pay a higher price on items that are off of that core list. And so our proposal just flattens that and gives the same discount across the board on 29,000 items instead of an incredible discount on 293 items and not near as much of a discount on the other items. And the analysis of the 20,000 items showing that that indeed under our structure those would be cheaper, to me shows that overall it is a more competitive offer.
Well, I wasn't aware of they priced the top 250 as a loss leader.
They may, more than likely they do, but that has actually been doing a percent off contract style of contract actually has been the practice in the state for over 20 years. We give you, it used to be just when it was just the state, we do the top 10 and ask what percentage off of that, and so or what are those fixed prices, and then you get a percentage off of everything else.
I'm just trying to get to the bottom of what they offer in competitive. I hear what he's saying, but I also hear what the other gentleman saying as well in the committee of what is the, how do you really look at these numbers to make sense out of it and to make a decision. So that's where it gets a little difficult. Now, my suggestion was to look at those top 250, make a comparison, are they competitive on those, but obviously that's not how they're looking at it.
And I will tell you that you can essentially get a box of paper clips for a penny, which is very difficult to have someone in a retail environment provide a box for a penny consistently.
Yeah, we'll acknowledge we can't compete with those prices on those 250 items, but when you expand it to all 29,000 items, we believe we are offering a competitive value.
Are there any other questions in regards to the conflict and the price competition on QC's offer?
I think I have a question. The catalog that's going to have 29,000 items, the current catalog that we have with Staples, there are quite a few restricted items. Is your catalog going to show clearly that which items are restricted so when the buyers go in, there's no guesswork as to can we buy this or not?
Yes. Our intention is to set up what's called a punch out, which would mean state purchasers would see only the available items on this contract and not the additional items. We carry additional items beyond just 29,000 for our other non-state customers to purchase, but state purchasers would only have these available and would only see that when they either log on to ProcureAZ, and that's what the punch out is. Or if they log on to our website, the catalog would be limited to contract items.
How would you go about gathering that information on what isn't allowed to be sold on that punch out list?
Well,
it's the product list that that's on the proposal.
The 29,000 or so restrictions on the ACI conflicted items that they printed.
Yeah, so that 29,000 is the catalog, or will be the catalog for the state, and a punch-out, for those of you that aren't familiar, is it basically would connect our backend of our website where we manage all these products with ProcureAZ, which is the backend where state purchasers can make their purchase. So a state purchaser would log into ProcureAZ and they would make their purchases there through that website, and only the contract items would come through.
Sounds like you had a thought.
Always.
Okay.
I just wondered if anyone on the committee or if you all have heard anything from or had reached out to Staples to hear what their thoughts are about this process. I mean, the last thing we want to do is end up in a contentious situation, of course. Did anybody chat with them? Not that it's your obligation to do that, but.
Did not, on a couple of different reasons why. The contract for office supplies is now handled through WSCA, which is a multi-state cooperative contract. The state can use that contract only if we sign a participating addendum that allows us to access that. It also is the general practice of the state that we have the ability to make a multiple award situation, and we never guarantee a contractor all of the business or a portion of the business or a segment. We never make any kind of guarantees on usage across the contract. If the committee were to accept QC's offer, they would be treated just like any other contractor who may have submitted an offer against a solicitation in the state name.
So am I to interpret that there's no risk of protest?
Yes, Staples would have no right of protest in this process.
I have a couple questions on other topics. Did you want to go there now, or do you want to?
Is it the second item? It's not the second item.
Well, that's one.
Do that one, because I've got an answer to that one. There's anything else on there.
Okay. One of the main motivations I think that this committee has is employment for individuals who are disabled and need the employment. I'm looking back on page 3 of the executive overview, about halfway down, where you talk about your proposal can provide permanent full-time employment for up to 16 individuals with disabilities through 8 delivery crews, etc. That's kind of vague language, which I think you would certainly admit. What guarantees do you make as to the number of individuals that you will be able to hire? And I know your intentions are good, but how do we know that we're going to get that many or more hired to meet that requirement?
Well, that 16 is based on our estimate that in order to serve the state's office supply needs, we would need to establish 8 delivery crews with 2 working individuals with disabilities on each of those crews. And that's in addition to the program staff that are employed with the program, which will also grow in order to meet this need. This is a big state. Much of it is separated geographically, and so that we believe we will need 8 crews and possibly more in order to serve the major population centers. And so we look at it as a liberal estimate and really a minimum starting point, having those 2 individuals in each of these major population centers. But a liberal estimate, and that could conceivably be much bigger than that.
So does your cost model include the cost of the trucks, the gas, the requirements to run the vehicle, the cost of the labor, and are these 16 people working full-time?
Yes, they are working full-time. Part of the cost model that you mentioned, they are DD-funded GSE crews. So the labor's paid or subsidized in part by the Division of Developmental Disabilities, and then the operating expenses of the vehicles are come out of the revenues from this contract.
So these jobs, the folks that are doing these jobs don't stay on these jobs, correct?
don't stay on these jobs?
Yeah, this is a training program. DD doesn't fund things forever.
No, from what we're running, operating currently, the individuals that are working on these job crews, which there's only about three delivery crews at this point in time, Prescott, Phoenix, and Flagstaff, but they are permanent employees. Now, there is more opportunity in the warehouses where it takes to, where the sorting and the prepping of the delivery supply or the supply delivery, those are more training opportunities.
So how do I understand the financials then? The three or six people that you have now that are full-time?
They're not full-time, no. Well, the ones in Flagstaff are, but the ones in YEI and Phoenix are not full-time.
So are they supported by developmental disability funds?
Yes.
Okay, and that goes on forever?
Potentially, yes.
Why potentially?
If I may, it's the goal of everybody serving these individuals to, if appropriate, eventually transition them to full unsupported community employment, if that's appropriate. And so it's an indefinite position as long as it's the appropriate.
Does your cost model work without that DDD support?
For the delivery crew? No, I don't think so.
How much is the support?
It's a ratio. So if there's two clients to one job coach, I want to say it's $14, $15 per hour.
Per person?
Per client, yes.
And that's being paid by?
By DDD.
That's being paid by DDD. And then what we're doing is contracting with these other CNATIs who will be operating that crew, billing DDD for the services they provide for the crew that they employ. And then we're contracting with them and paying them a portion of the revenues for the products themselves that they're delivering on top of the revenues they're receiving from DDD.
So the employees receive no benefits? No vacation, or medical benefits?
Our employees receive benefits, vacation.
No, I'm talking about the employees on this contract. The DDD employees.
My son had, he works for a company too. And okay. He has benefits already, and DDD pays for the program too. So they already have their own benefits through DDD.
Doing our employees
are you talking about health care and those things?
Yeah. I mean, health care, our
employees receive
vacation
and sick time and other benefits, just like our staff that are not disabled. They are full-time permanent staff, just like any other staff at our company. And the other bit that we're really proud of about this model is many of the GSE programs around pay compensatory wages, sub-minimum wage. We do not. We pay minimum wage or above for all of these positions, and we're asking our partners who are employing these individuals through this delivery model to do the same.
Yeah. I'm just having trouble understanding the logic of DDD paying this forever, you know, forevermore. When most rehabilitation programs, whether it be DDD or RSA, the whole point of it is to lead to a job in the private sector or a job where the federal government is not continuing to subsidize them. So I'm just having trouble understanding how that works. I've never seen a program like that where you're working, you're considered an employee of you, but forever I'm going to get subsidized. How does that work?
I think this has been happening for years with DDD.
Yeah, that's the group support.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you're right that it is the eventual goal, when appropriate, to transition those individuals that are appropriate for community employment to move on. But that isn't appropriate for all individuals.
So how many people do you think will go through the program and get employment through this?
We're estimating in Flagstaff alone in the warehouse that prepares and gets all the items ready. We're estimating just in Flagstaff, 35 individuals will be trained in a year.
So there will be a number of them that will be going on. You're talking about in Flagstaff, you're talking about the delivery system in Flagstaff?
The delivery, the order taking, the order prepping, and the delivery.
So they'll be trained, and the idea was they go to a private sector job?
The ones in the call center, you know, processing orders, doing order, you know, all of the back-end information, yes. And then in the warehouse, they gain warehouse skills, proper warehouse labor type skills that do transition into the warehouse, yeah.
Is your estimate of 35 people in Flagstaff based on being the sole office supply contractor?
No. The sole,
No, I was asking in the context of this contract.
No, and then what my concern is right now, I have a Staples, and they want to be listed on the contract as, if I continue with Staples, does that change their estimate of hire?
No, it doesn't. And we're anticipating, I think we said last time, about 5% of the state spend on this $3.5 million contract. And that's, and we get that number from our other set-aside contract, which we've experienced about 5% of the spend.
Just want to make sure.
Just one last question on the DDD payment. You receive about $15 per hour per person from DDD for these folks, and then how much are you paying each individual? What's their rate of pay?
We pay minimum, we start at minimum wage, and then they grow from there. And then the rest of the of those revenues pay for the job coach.
So can you give me an example if a person makes minimum wage and they're also, and that's being paid by DDD, that's the only money that they have available to, or is there another subsidy?
Available to them as...
Okay, let's just say I'm one of your employees disabled doing the, doing the delivery.
Uh-huh.
What am I going to take home for pay?
Minimum wage.
Minimum wage.
Plus benefits.
DDD
not paying that. Like another
contract. Okay. Who's paying the minimum wage?
Well, that comes from us, from contracts with the state.
Okay. So DDD is giving you money, and you're paying minimum wage.
Right.
No.
No.
They're giving you, DDD is giving you money for your staff or something.
Right. Well,
not,
technically,
not to pay, your
we do not. Right. That's a good point. There are agencies out there that do pay commensurate wages, which is below minimum wage, and that requires the Department of Labor to come in and do time studies so that you can pay commensurate wages. We don't pay commensurate wages. We don't pay below minimum wage.
You're basically paying a training wage.
I guess if you want to say that, yeah. I mean, if you want to look at it that way, yes. But we're paying our clients or our employees minimum wage or better.
Okay, and DDD is paying you for the job coach?
That's what the contract is for. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's where the ratio of 60% is met, is through two clients and one job coach.
Mm-hmm. So each job coach handles only two clients?
That's correct. In the delivery crew. In the call center, it might be a one-on-one, depending on the contract that's used, whether it's behavioral health or work adjustment through RSA, or even ESC or ISC through DDD.
But the coach would be a full-time person dedicated only to that one individual or those two individuals?
That crew, that's correct. That's the idea. Currently, you know, Prescott, we don't have, you know, the sales in place to employ these guys full time. And that's where this contract comes into play.
Excuse me, I make a comment. There are different pay ratios, depending on the ratio of job coaches to clients. one to one, one to two, one to six, you know, one in between there, one to four. I can't remember all the levels, but one to six is another way. And it's, of course, the higher the ratio, the lower per hour you get on that, so.
And the one to two just makes sense with the delivery model. You really can't have a delivery crew larger than three people, or you're going to have folks that are just driving around without productive work to do. Because that's, you know, beyond that, we'd have four guys delivering two boxes.
So out of your deliveries, what percentage will be delivered by your folks, and what percentage would be drop shipped to the location?
Our goal is to serve the majority of the population centers across the state. And I can't exactly speculate on exact percentage, I'd just be speculating. But I would guess that most of the state's purchases are in those population centers.
Do currently on display contracts require next day delivery? I'm asking.
Yes. They usually have a 24-hour delivery.
24 hour, is it desktop or to the location?
To the location, not to desktop.
Yeah, they don't do desktop.
If I read the contract correctly, they have 4 days to deliver.
So have those kinds of details been worked out on this contract? And what we're approving?
Their offer is within 48 hours to desktop after receipt of order, if I remember correctly.
Four days for 100% of the items.
And then 48 hours for.
And then there's a 2 o'clock cutoff or something.
Yes. And our analysis shows that we're able to meet that timeline by studying our current orders. We currently have 1,100 customers that are spread out across the state, although more than half are up in Northern Arizona. And we did a random audit of orders in preparation for our toner contract that we were awarded last year. Randomly audited several hundred different orders and found that we met that timeline 100% of the time.
So I guess I would ask, what kinds of ironclad assurances can we put in the contract to make sure that they meet the hiring targets that would be established, I assume, in the contract, and if they don't, appropriate things would happen.
To that point, you were asking, you know, how many and how can we assure that we hire 16 individuals. All of these estimates are based on sales. If the state doesn't buy from us, there's no way we can meet those. You know, we go out and we have two full-time sales reps trying to gain state business.
I get that, but what I'm wondering is, how can we put something in the contract that says, you know, for the first X dollars of sales, you know, you'll have not less than four employees,
right?
And for the next increment, not less than eight, or whatever the numbers would be. I'm not trying to be punitive here at all, but I just want to make sure that there is language in the contract that says this is going to be done.
My point would be, more importantly, is that there's a requirement to participate in state set aside, and I think we're going through a process currently to define what that percentage means, the language behind that percentage. But the question would really be to anybody that wants to participate in a state set aside contract is, do you meet that requirement of 60%? And will you always meet that requirement of 60%? It's not about how many, it's about percentages. Otherwise, it would be in the contract on a number. So I think that we need to stay focused on the fact that if you're falling within your 60% requirement, then that should be satisfactory to this committee. A number, you know, if you have 16 people with disabilities, then you should have X people without disabilities. And that's the real question, and you have to address that question.
So I agree with you, and to I don't know if that was a question, but yes, we can do that. So far as Mr. Apperson's question is,
if you're
really
doing the math
on
the reverse way, that's fine. But
okay.
I just would like to have some sort of assurance that we're going to meet the targets that you say you're going to meet. That's fine.
Their offer is as stated. They have the opportunity to amend it. The state can't kind of say, if you don't do this, you lose your contract.
what we can do is, based on the projection of sales and how they've presented the offer to us, at time of renewal, we can look at how well we matched up, how well did it serve the state, how well did they meet the current statutory definitions of 60%, and that's part of the challenge. I think we'd like to see both meeting the terminology that was defined in the statute, but also increasing participation from the clientele base. But there's nothing truly I can from the state say, I'll give you this contract if you do this. If that's an offer they make that the committee would accept, that's one thing. But we can't impose.
Oh, I'm just going from the language that they have in this document that says what it says, and it just, if they're making that commitment, that's great. Let's make sure they keep it.
And we can do that if the committee recommends awarding this contract at time of renewal, we can go back to validate that percentage of that estimate.
How often is it renewed?
It's annually.
Can I ask specifically, are you looking at our proposal can provide a permanent full-time employment for up to 16?
Okay. Yeah, that's just kind of.
If I can briefly comment on that. Our sole interest in this is not to sell office supplies. Office supplies for us is a means to an end, and our sole interest here is in creating employment for people with disabilities.
Good. Glad to hear that. That's our interest as well.
Is there any other questions?
I have a question that has nothing to do with QC. But if I come to you, I just had a meeting with, let's say I just had a meeting with Herman Miller and they put together cubicles. And you already have a cubicle supplier. And I come to you and I come to the Southside community and I say, hey, I partnered with Herman Miller. They'll provide all the cubicles. And I'm going to use people with disabilities for installation. I'm having trouble with the idea of an office supply company getting the door open to do business with the state of Arizona, or a Herman Miller getting the door open to do business with the state of Arizona through the set-aside process without having to go out for competitive bid. And the reason I look at that is because of the scale. You can say you'll only get 5%, you might get 50. That's the other side of that coin. If you got two salespeople, you sell a good story, you tell them it's supporting people with disabilities, you might get 50. Where do you hit the line where it's now potentially going to be a problem with the private sector? And this program comes under scrutiny as a result of making these kinds of deals. Now, don't get me wrong with the question. I'm all for supporting employment of people with disabilities. I'm also weighing that against the responsibility that sitting in this chair, and I sit here because I have to, because the statute says I have to.
But you enjoy being here.
Oh,
with
us. I enjoy Yeah. So I'm just for the good of, you know, and here we are in the process of trying to redefine ourselves, which is a good thing. I'm just trying to look more broadly at the situation and say, are we setting up some kind of a precedent, or does each case stand on its own? I don't know. I don't know how I'd react to the Herman Miller situation if someone came in and said they did that. But there's typically in this industry, and what I'm saying is nonprofits that are trying to create employment for people with disabilities. What you find is partnerships with 3M, let's say. And so what an organization like I would do is they would give me post-it notes. And so 3M would get on to state set aside with post-it notes only. But what I would be doing is getting the raw paper, big stack and big squares. I'd have machines operated by people with disabilities that would be cutting them down into a size. They would be packaging them, they would be labeling them, they would be boxing them, they would be shipping them. So a significant amount of labor is the typical model here, okay? And it's usually done one at a time. It's a post-it note, it's a rubber glove, it's something. I've never seen, and I went and looked at the three set-aside programs that we have been exploring, Florida, Texas, and New York. No one has a contract like this. There isn't one out there. And so I'm just asking the question, what keeps me from coming in next meeting with a deal with some company that could be worth $3 million for our organization? I'm asking the procurement professionals in the room, because I'm not one, okay? I'm asking the question because what assurances do I have that saying yes to this is not gonna down the road cause a whole bunch of other problems?
Right now there's nothing. As defined, and that kind of leads into the second point, but currently there is no requirement what percentage of the contract, AKA if it's your Herman Miller, what percentage of the provision of that contract has to be provided by a CNATI or a disabled to order to qualify for the set-aside. So it's not like the definition of a small business, which is, you know, less than 100 employees and or less than $4 million annually. You don't have a definition of program in that fashion.
So what does the 60% mean? Or tell us that later.
And we'll get to that. But so basically, just to answer your question, right now, your Herman Miller contract could be presented to this committee for consideration. So, before we go off, is there any other questions for Quality Connection? To the second point, or the other point that the committee on the 17th asked us to research is to work with the Attorney General's response in regards to that 60%, how that applies across to, is it to the company, is it to the contract, is it to the whatever. The response I got was that technically program is not defined in statute. There is no case law or relevant statute that we could find, or that they could find, that defined what a program was. Given that, you kind of default to what is the commonly understood Webster's dictionary definition of program. Of course, it has many, but the ones that were pointed out were a plan or a procedure for dealing with some matter, or an activity that can be participated in at a community center, camp, resort, whatever. So an activity as well as a procedure. So it appears that the 60% applies to more than just those people working on the contract, but not necessarily the entire organization or company. So look at it if you're looking at a company with multiple divisions. Maybe one of those divisions is something that you would look at to apply that 60% against, but you wouldn't necessarily look all across all of United Airways to say all of United Airways has to meet the 60%. Maybe they're cleaning crews and airplanes do. But the recommendation is that the committee really needs to identify the relevant factors that we feel are important to define the program, and that we use those relevant factors in a consistent fashion to apply to contracts or to request for contracts that are submitted by this committee. So we have the opportunity then to deal with a Herman Miller style of offer. If you, as a working group or as a committee, gets together to define those relevant factors, and they could be anywhere from financial to subsidized, how long subsidies could last to make sure this happens, how many people are moved from a training position to a permanent position. So those are things that I think we can define as we define program. And I think we should bring them back, vote on them, make them part of minutes, and put them into place so that as we transition off, whoever's transitioning onto this committee has that framework to move forward with.
So are we talking more about guidelines versus statute? Mm-hmm.
Yes, at this point.
At this point.
So how would that apply to the current request we have before us?
You cannot apply it to the current request before us because they do not exist now. You have to use the existing statute and language in the existing statute with the parameters of, it doesn't apply just to the contract, but it doesn't apply to the whole. Is that understandable? Does that kind of...
Sure.
I tried to take it from lawyer ease into human speak. I'm not quite sure I got all the way there. So that is the secondary. That kind of takes care of all of those elements that the July 17th committee meeting asked us to research. So given that, I'd like to move to the next item on the agenda, which is dealing with making a motion on the proposal from the Quality Connections contract request for office products. Is there a motion?
Also move.
There's a motion to move to accept it?
Second.
Is it to move to accept it?
Yes,
okay.
I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure that that's what the motion was.
Yes, move to accept the proposal.
I have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion?
I have a question. Is it possible to, as a condition, since this is kind of getting into a new zone, in a sense, to have quarterly status reports about how things are going? Can we do that?
The committee, there's discussion. Has anybody got a comment on the request for quarterly?
Well, they have a requirement to report quarterly anyway. What they don't have a requirement to do, though, is to tell how many people with disabilities are.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, yes. To tell us how things are going with
hiring
and all of that.
So,
but we're saying, is that fair to everybody else who has contracts, who's not reporting that?
We have to be consistent.
I mean,
so we have an option. Are you moving to amend the motion that we approve the contract as proposed by QC with the amendment that they do quarterly reporting on numbers of employees that meet the requirement as well as sales?
I don't want to make this a crazy motion situation. We can do that if you like, but can you give us that information on a quarterly basis voluntarily?
Absolutely.
Without a problem? That would be helpful.
We'd be happy to.
We're trying to do our due diligence here, and so I think that would be helpful. We don't want to impose.
We'll be excited to report how many of you
excited to hear from.
Just as a comment in general, the committee can, at time of the renewal, make additional requirements as you continue to go forward. If you feel that that's a requirement that we should consider in the future, so the next time, I believe we have a couple of contracts coming up at the next quarterly meeting that we could then consider if that's something that you feel is information that the committee should be requesting, that we can move forward with that as part of the contingency of renewing the contracts. Okay, so the question has been answered. I still have the motion to accept QC's proposal. The second, is there any other discussion? Hearing none, I'll entertain a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
So it's a nay that you're saying nay because you did oppose?
I oppose.
Okay, I just want to make sure because if you said aye, that was the first one. So we have one nay, nine ayes, motion carries. At this point in time, we are to line item or item number five on the agenda, committee comments and suggestions. Does the committee have any comments or suggestions?
Yeah, one comment is if we're going to have to review proposals, I'd certainly have to see them a day before the meeting. Okay. Another suggestion, I'd like to be able to see the people that are talking at the committee and reconfigure this room so that I can see them once they speak.
I think the suggestion that we define program going forward is a very good one. How would you like to proceed to achieve that?
Don't we have a subcommittee?
Well, and I guess that's an option. We have the option of referring it to the subcommittee. However,
do that or do it at the poll or whatever.
I think the subcommittee does have a very large task in front of it already. This is certainly a key portion of that. We could put together a smaller working group to pull together at least a recommended definition and then potentially present that to the subcommittee or to the whole board. What is going to the board?
I'd be interested just to see the direction that the definition is going to go, because that would help me understand how we need to, you know, approach it. Because, you know, the definition of program in my mind, I think it's a common definition, is program means the folks that work on those jobs that you're setting aside this work for. If you have that percentage, 60%, to meet that requirement, they're doing the work, then that qualifies. Now, if we're going to add other pieces to it or qualifiers to it, then we need to have a deeper discussion as a group, perhaps in the subcommittee, to understand that, you know, are those relevant qualifiers, or are we trying to redefine something that's already been defined by DDD or someone else? So those are my concerns when I hear the discussion the way it's going so far.
And I think that we need to be consistent with whatever we do, whatever requirements we're placing on any of the vendors, that across the board and that reportability, that might be part of it, and that would be part of our guidelines in the reporting and such. And I too would like to see, you know, how many people with disabilities are being employed through contracts and how they're progressively increasing and it's, you know, creating that. Also, you know, for consideration, maybe not now, but down the road, how many eventually were competitively placed? How many people are able to be out and completely independent? That's a really great thing. We have to do it anyway, so I mean, that's an easy reportability. So
would the committee be open to the suggestion of potentially a folding meeting as a working group to work on the pros and cons of the definition of program that we find acceptable to use as the relevant guiding factors for the program? That kind of releases the subcommittee from...
We're having enough fun as it is.
I know you're very busy.
It's going to be the committee at whole, too.
I think
that warrants a day session, and whatever materials we can get in advance to be prepared for the meeting would be helpful.
So it probably will not be before the next quarterly.
That's fine.
looking date-wise, I probably would say sometime in the November timeframe. To give us a little bit of time to find a date that works for everybody and to pull some relevant information together. An ask I would make of the committee then at this point would be for the committee to potentially write down their thoughts, or if they have definitions of programs or what they thought that truly kind of compensate or cover, if you could send that to me via email. And then that lets me to kind of consolidate everybody's thoughts, and we can use that as the basis of discussion when we hold the working group, so we're not starting from ground zero. And it's relevant if it comes from another state. It's relevant if it comes from another program that you might be associated with. So the parameters of it doesn't have to be just this set-aside program that you're looking at. Any other comments or suggestions? Okay, we're now at the call to the public. Is there anybody from the public that wishes to speak?
Mr. Chair, I would like to ask the committee to, research what the rule is for open meeting laws. I mean, is the committee subject to the open meeting laws?
Yeah. The working group would be open meeting.
Okay,
because we have a quorum at that point.
Okay, but is the public available or allowed to meet with anyone or discuss with any old committee member about a proposal or about concerns or about suggestions that they may have with so far as these new rules going forward or that are being developed?
I'm gonna have to get back to you on that one. I believe you can actually talk to one-on-one, any committee member. Committee members can't get together to discuss unless it's at this meeting.
Barbara, in the past, I think Jean allowed that, the one-on-one, but not a group.
Yeah, you can't have, you know, can't get two or three together to do it at the same time.
You can't have more than four of them.
Yeah, it would be just like working with your legislative representative. You can do the one-on-one stuff, you can talk with them about your concerns, you can answer questions, you can do all that type of stuff. But any official action is taken by the committee as a whole when you have one present at a meeting. So, just because I'm talking about that, there's also, if you make a request, there can be special meetings held. And we do quarterly meetings to try to kind of maximize people's time and effort, obviously. But if there is an issue that wants a special meeting, we certainly have the ability to address that and fully schedule a special meeting.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else from the public that would like to comment?
See, I've got a question. In the panel, the board, the committee going through the due diligence process, regardless of what the contract's for, the set-aside contract, does anybody on the panel, on the committee, on the board ever go and visit or view the facility that they're considering making an award to, that just to make sure everything's in line?
Not that I know of.
Has that ever taken place?
Not that I know of. In the subcommittee, there's information like that in some of the documentation that we're reviewing for the future. But as of right now, there's no requirement to do that, and I don't believe that it's been done on a regular basis. I do know that the set-aside committee 8 or 10 years ago actually held a meeting at our site, and you know, they got a tour as a result of that, plus had the meeting at our site.
I used to attend some of those meetings.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that was discontinued.
Probably the leader changed. I think it was John, I can't remember his name. John Adler? Was doing that, and then Jean came in and, you know, she, no one suggested it to her, or...
Again, I was just wondering what the... When you look at the requirements for the due diligence process and just making sure that those that are putting forth presentations and opportunities to the committee, when you look at the set-aside, that all the ducks are in a row, all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed, and everything's above board to qualify to participate in such. And I don't know if that makes any...
I don't know if that makes any sense or not. My answer to you is there isn't a real due diligence process. It doesn't exist. There's things that are required that you present to the committee, like, you know, the list is in there. But is that really due diligence? I don't think so. There would be more information required normally, and probably would include a visit to the site. So we really don't have anything that says we have to do that.
I was just curious how that was addressed.
Yeah. But if you read the statute, the requirements are in there, and it just says you submit some information, and we look at it, and about it.
Okay. Thank you for answering.
I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying that's what it is today.
If I may just comment, I think the nature of the business that some of us do, we're at a lot of those locations anyway, not for that purpose, but for other purposes. So we're aware of what they're doing, what they're capable of doing and such. So from that perspective, you know, it's just a different twist. It's not a mandate, but I think we're all pretty familiar with what all the other agencies do in the state of Arizona due to our relationships with one another. So those that present themselves oftentimes are credible. Well, anybody I've had come that I know of are very credible. And I've been doing it for a while.
Yeah.
Don't you have to qualify to, I mean, you have to submit information and have to qualify to be able to come forward?
Yeah, I guess the statute doesn't like this.
Yeah, that's so it's not like this anybody can come off the street and be sent or, you know.
So certified, it has to serve people with disabilities. It's a nonprofit activity that satisfies the following. Is organized under the laws of the state or another state, is operated in the interest of the disabled individuals and the net income, which does not inure in whole or in part the benefit of any shareholder or other individual. So it's a nonprofit. Complies with any applicable occupational health and safety standards required by the laws of the United States and of the state of Arizona. Supposed to be a safe environment. It defines disability as disabled individual means an individual who, because of the nature of the individual's disability, is not able to fully participate in competitive employment and for whom specialized employment and training is necessary by a qualified nonprofit organization through the Department of Economic Security or Health Services. So that's one definition of what's required. And it also says to qualify for state set-aside contracts, the certified nonprofit must maintain an employment ratio of at least 60% of program employees with significant disabilities.
Now, when you look at 60%, let's say all of us in this room constitute a company.
Yep.
So 60% of those individuals would need to fall under that qualification.
Based on Barbara's explanation today, no, it's just the activity that you're providing to the state. So it would be not everyone.
And again, that's a question because I don't know.
That's for us to now define, I believe. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yep. And let's see if there's anything else.
It was going to be just on the table, did you?
And I think there's a couple of other requirements about you must submit some information about your organization, but I'm not saying it right.
Yeah, in order to be.
Yeah.
Well, if I may add, too, in order to be a vendor with DES, you go through other qualifiers and such. So it's not like it's tiered. So you qualify here, and then you get qualified here, and so ultimately, by the time you come to the table, you've been qualified quite a bit. And people have been to your facility. Part of being, you know, sanctioned by DES is they come and do at least annual quality, you know, checks on the entities involved. So it's there's a whole infrastructure of compliance in that with regards to agencies and entities that are contracted with the state that we have to follow. So it's not like just anybody coming off the street that's saying.
Right. Well, this is all new to me. I'm not trying to be devil's advocate.
No, it is
a bad person. I'm not sure how that works. So somebody goes up once a year, for example, to QC and checks out their facility?
At least annually.
And it might be several different departments, Department of Health, DDD, there's
RSA,
the fire department.
And then if you have federal government contracts, you got that whole Department of Justice, Department of Labor. I mean, we can go on. So yeah, there's a whole infrastructure compliance and requirements that have to be met. Your annual audits and such, financial audits that are submitted, they're public. Reporting of anybody making over in excess of a certain amount of money. It's access to anybody. So, yeah, that's all public knowledge.
Again, I'm considered a newbie, all this stuff.
It is an excellent question. Thank you.
Yeah, we love to host tours if you're ever in Flagstaff.
Great. Well, thank you for your time.
Sorry, are you considered a nonprofit company?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I have the other stuff just to close this out. Of the State Procurement Code, Chapter 23, it's R2-7100. And it says a nonprofit organization requesting certification by the committee as a nonprofit agency for disabled individuals shall submit the following: the name of the organization, the address, the contract name, and the contact name and contact information, description of the nonprofit activity center, evidence of the organization's nonprofit status, the statement that the business is operating in accordance with 412636 of the Arizona Revised Statute, a statement of the occupational safety that follows the safety rules, signature and title of the responsible party within the applicant's organization, I assume it's president, CEO. And then the committee is to review that and approve, table, or decline. And that's all that's written.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions, concerns from the public? Okay, hearing none, we'll call it adjourned at 2:39. Thank you all very much for attending. Interest is always appreciated. Don't think it's a problem. We certainly have some steps to make in the future. Not a problem. So we will, do we know when our next scheduled, October the 15th is our next regularly scheduled quarterly meeting. And then we'll be looking for something potentially in November for work. If you have any problems or concerns, you can let me know. But thank you all for attending.
Great.
And so the question for the next round is to go up. So you might as well work it out.